Tech giants a sleazebag, cell carriers record your every move, and the law that could end the internet. All that and more on the Slongcast.
I'm Hard Rock.
I'm Coco.
I'm Joe.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Slongcast, the long-awaited last episode of 2011. I am your host, Kevin Slonka, and with me, we have two guests this week. To my right, Mr. Ryan Lancey.
Howdy.
Howdy.
Duty.
Not going to say that one. And to my left, Mr. Matt Hunt.
Hey, guys.
How's it going?
Very well, thanks.
So, it's been a while. It's been like 2 months if I looked at the date on my blog properly.
Yeah. We got over that fight and everything.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that whole thing that made the news and
apologized.
Yeah, whatever. No, we've all been busy. Somebody here had to go get married. Who was that?
Oh, I guess that was me.
Yay. I promise not to overuse sound effects. I promise.
Too late.
The real reason we haven't done this for like 2 months is because I started school and just got too much work. It's like having another job on top of the three that I already have.
Interesting.
Yeah, so next...
How's that going for you?
It's going well. Got all A's my first semester, so yay! Yeah, where's the applause there?
Yeah! Who's running this thing?
Ah, that guy sucks.
Who's the producer?
Yeah, so school's going well. It's just a lot of work. In addition to three jobs, you know, it's full-time school, so it's a lot of writing. So needless to say, next semester, we won't have a Slongcast every week like we have in the past, but I'll try to do more than once every 2 months. So how's you guys' Christmas? Merry Christmas, everybody. It's holidays after Christmas.
I had a great Christmas.
You,
yep,
met?
Yep, had a great time.
Awesome.
Got some model trains from some family.
Oh, model trains.
Any Christmas with trains.
Did you get what's his name? From the kids show.
No, not into those ones. Those
Thomas,
are models.
Thomas the Tank Engine.
Thomas.
the names whose names should not be said. No, I'm
just kidding. I don't get it.
The one whose name should not be uttered or whatever. Never mind. Oh, no, I'm not into toy trains. I'm into model trains.
Oh,
it's a huge difference.
Whatever. You and your action figures. No trains for you, Matt?
No, we pulled my wife's Red Ryder BB gun out of retirement.
Ooh, I saw you post,
yeah,
about it.
Awesome.
Yeah, so we shot at some tin cans with the Red,
nice,
Ryder BB gun with the compass in the stock. And the
Are those new glasses? Did you break your glasses?
No. We all escaped
poke
unscathed.
Your eye out, kid.
Nobody shot their eye out. We did pretty well.
Nice.
So they were wrong. You won't shoot your eye.
Huh. Yeah. Who would have thought?
Yeah.
I've never seen that movie.
Oh, really?
Never.
We'll invite you to the family showing next year. It's a tradition.
Is the family showing a DVD showing or a tune in at the proper time on TBS?
It's a Blu-ray showing.
Oh, Blu-ray, yeah, showing.
The proper time, you mean all day for like every day on TBS?
Exactly, that's what I mean. Like show up at the time whenever the movie starts during a 24-hour period.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get into some news articles. Huh? I will not overuse these. I only have ones to introduce sections, and that is it. And I must say that I apologize in advance if the show goes downhill, because at least two of us have alcohol with us.
Three?
I finished mine.
Oh, Ryan finished his. Okay, so all of us had alcohol at some point. Two shots of tequila and beer and a fake margarita, which is Mountain Dew and tequila.
I've switched to vanilla Coke now, so I think I'm good.
Hmm. I must say, this 1800 tequila and this fake margarita, I like it better than Patron.
Mm.
So those commercials did not lie. That Sopranos dude in the black suit, he was awesome. So anyways, first story of the week. This one kind of, when I saw it, I thought, oh, this is not good. The title of the article from Gawker. So right away, you should know, probably don't trust it, but how the voice of tech leaked his own sex chat. Article talks about Leo Laporte. Everybody knows him who knows things about tech. He was on Tech TV. He now does Twit has his own shows on the internet about everything within tech. You know, everybody loves him. So when the story came out, I kind of thought, really, Leo, did he really do this? And did either of you guys see this article before it got out on the list for the Slongcast?
No.
So what was your first reaction when you saw it? Because the his response hadn't come out at that time.
I mean, it surprises me that, you know, that when you first told me, I didn't hear about it. You told me about it, and I was like, oh, wow, that's pretty bad. But then it turns out that...
Right. Yeah, so Leo responded. He wrote a blog post on his site saying, you know, I'm sorry this instant message conversation got out, but I don't like to bring my personal life into my work. My wife and I have been separated for over a year, and yes, I am dating, you know, my company's CEO. Everybody knows about it, family-wise. I just don't air my personal problems on air. But it turns out that during This Week in Google in October, Leo accidentally brought up his Google Voice page, and, you know, split second, because he realized he screwed up, and one of his fans saw it, screen capped it, must have sent it to Gawker. I've been trying to think, who did Gawker do this to in the past 6 months or so? There was somebody else that this, you know, Nick Denton, the guy who runs Gawker, like...
The question would maybe better asked, who didn't?
Because Gawker does this to everybody. But yeah. I remember us talking about some person in the tech world that Gawker did this to, and they turned out to be wrong also. But
well, there was... Was it them that did the picture of Steve Jobs, like, who was really gaunt, and which ended up, I think, guessing being true, but they released that picture of Steve Jobs that was... He was being held up by a friend, and he was just real thin.
It might have been.
Yeah, I think it was.
I really
Gawker.
Can't remember what we talked about.
I mean, I try not to. I don't pay much attention to the, like, rumor mill stuff, and I don't know if, you know, tech celebrities fall under the same banner as, like, I don't know, politicians, and that their personal lives are free game. I don't think that either should be, really.
Yeah, I don't think so.
You know, maybe extreme cases of, like, illegal activity.
And I mean, Leo's a very public person. Like, people know his phone number, his personal phone number, where he lives. He invites people to come to the show, you know, which is a couple blocks from his house. And, you know, he's a very public person, but he did a good job of keeping this part of his life out of the, I don't know, out of the limelight. Mm-hmm. But Matt, did you know Leo?
Like,
only
from his work. Like, I couldn't But I couldn't have told you if he was married or not. Like,
oh, okay.
I knew nothing about his personal life. I honestly don't care that much about his personal life. What I thought about it wasn't so much that I was interested in the marital infidelity aspect of it, but simply the screw-up of showing an explicit chat log during your
right.
show, whether you're cheating on someone or not. That's just kind of...
It's kind of boneheaded.
You know, a bad screw-up.
Yeah.
You know what they say? Don't mix work and pleasure.
That's true.
Yep.
It's just kind of funny, you know, Leo being literally the tech guy. You know, that's his radio show on the weekends. And, you know, I guess it shows everybody screws up.
Yeah, if he were the marriage guy, then I'd look at it from a different angle.
But obviously he's not.
Yeah.
He's the tech guy, and even tech guys have little screw-ups. But for those of you who only saw the Gawker article, it's not true. He's not a cheating sleazebag. You know, this is all legit, and people know about it, and now the world knows about it.
Yeah, what I did think was kind of funny about it, though, is, you know, I have separate work and personal emails, and the two don't mix. And I've run into people who use Gmail or something for their professional mail, and I've been at, like, software companies where they're running a demo for me, and the CEO has his Gmail up, and there's, like, emails from his wife and stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
And that always just seemed like a weird thing to mix to me, to try to keep the work stuff and the personal stuff.
Yeah, and I guess Google makes it easy because, you know, if you have Google apps for your domain or for your company, they make it easy enough to link up your personal Gmail account that you already had to make it all appear in one place. So I guess, you know, they're just making that much easier now for people to have these screw-ups.
Yeah, yeah. I'd rather just keep those domains separate.
Yeah, there's a interesting article that I saw from, like, was it Volkswagen? That they mandated that all their employees, like, the corporate email servers shut off after working hours now, and you cannot get new messages. Like, you can't. You can send them, but they won't get delivered till the next morning.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a stand for the whole, like, keep your family and and work life separate.
I'm very surprised that there wasn't like an up, you know, a revolt by the heads of the company.
Well, I think they're the ones that instantiated the, they want to support that behavior.
I think the attitude toward work-life balance is a little different.
Well, that's true. Yeah, because I know people that I've worked with, if email was down for a minute, you know, they were calling the help desk every 5 seconds. Why isn't this up? I'm losing business, blah, blah, blah. Whatever. So moving on. Our next article, ISO, the International Organization for Standardization, updated the C programming language standard. C has been around. How long has C been around? I mean, really?
Since 1968.
Like, it's the language that pretty much operating systems
Something
use.
Like that.
Right? You know, Linux, Windows, everything based written in C.
The first big use of it was when they rewrote the kernel for Unix in C on the PDP-11.
I guess I should have said Unix instead of Linux to get earlier. But yeah, they're updating it. And they're saying it provides greater compatibility with C++. Good or bad? What do you guys think about this? Do you care even?
I don't care much. A lot of my programming experience was in C. It's a language that I love. But really, since C89, I haven't followed any ISO updates to the standard. You know, one thing I was a little disappointed to see is that they introduced the double slash syntax for introducing comments. I'm not sure about that because I think it introduces a parsing difference into the language. You could actually get a change in the meaning of software because of that. Because of the way the parsing works, you could construct statements in old C that would be like for slash, where the slash is a division sign, then a slash star to introduce an old style comment, close that comment somewhere, end the division somewhere else. And if you allow double slash as the introduction to a comment syntax,
you
it changes
that.
The parsing of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was actually the one thing that I was going to bring up, was that some of these new things they've introduced could break things that have been out there for 20, 30 years.
Yeah. Now, in practice, I'm sure every compiler is going to have a compatibility flag to, you know, prohibit that.
Pop up
that
a syntax. Warning, this line will break.
Sure.
What about you, Ryan? Does C affect your work at all? Or
I haven't used, like, C itself directly in, you know, many years, so it's not going to affect my work, my day-to-day work. I like that they're keeping it up. You know, they're trying to keep the language alive and continuing updating it, making it more compatible with C++. I mean, I don't know if that's a huge benefit or not. I'm not a daily C programmer. I mean, I know C, but I most of my work is C# and more modern languages.
Yeah, I mean, I think C is still for college students. Like, that should be the language you start with, right? Do you guys agree? You know, have the base in C, because from there you can pretty much learn any newer language.
I don't know. I mean, I think there's, like, a lot to be said for teaching kids a functional language to begin, or you know, even... I don't know. I think it depends on what type of curriculum you have, and if you want to, you know, teach procedural languages first, and then
even that aside, just syntax style. You know, you could teach them Python because it's an easy language. It teaches good style in the way that you have to tab, but it's really unlike a lot of other languages. Whereas if you know C, the C style is the same as it is for .NET, for C++, for Java, for pretty much every major language. You know what
I mean? I think that's the Pascal style is what it really is.
So we should teach people Pascal.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that. I actually advocate less teaching of languages and more teaching of, like, concepts and that sort of thing.
But that aside, if you have to pick a language for kids to implement things that you teach them.
I learned to program on paper first. So, like, anybody who learns on a computer, I think they're big babies. They complain.
Nice.
So that's kind of how I look at it.
I actually learned on a computer. It was with BASIC, though, on an Apple IIe.
Well, I mean, I did have the cliche Apple IIe BASIC programming class that every, like, elementary student has.
Right, right.
I don't consider BASIC a true programming language. No, I mean, you know, I'm talking, like, college-level courses.
Right, right.
Once you get there, I think, you know, we started out with a language called FP, It's I think it just stands for functional programming, and it's all it's very I can't remember the name of the language it's based on, but it's everything's like a list, and you modify lists of numbers and that sort of thing, and it's very functional oriented. You know, everything's a function versus, you know, procedural, where like C is kind of a combination of procedural and functional. And
yeah, so no big thoughts against the updates, other than that one it could break stuff thing, which was really all that I looked at.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just something to be aware of.
Yeah. Okay. I for some reason I threw this in here because I thought one of you guys would have been like totally against it, and we were going to argue about it. But okay, this is awesome. No arguments yet. We have plenty of other articles for that, like this next one. The U.S. Congress authorizes offensive use of cyber warfare. So this is a pretty interesting. You know, first off, I don't know how long ago it was where our government accepted or stated outright that cyber warfare is a legitimate act of warfare. You know, what was that quote that we talked about on the show before? You know, you send us a virus and we'll send a missile down your chimney or something. Mm-hmm. It was something like that said by a congressman. So that was just defensive. But now they're like, no, if we're going to go to war with somebody, you know, online war is an option to strike people. What do you guys think of this?
I don't know why we're in the business of like offensive attacks, first of all. I don't think that retaliating a missile with a cyber attack is unbalanced, though, because a cyber attack could cause a lot of damage. We caused a lot of damage in Iran, supposedly. I don't know firsthand what that...
I mean, come on. We all know.
I don't. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I
we
know
don't
what the,
know,
I know what
know.
The news media tells us, and the news media tells us that that was something that we possibly did, and it was... We destroyed one of the nuclear refinement...
Stuxnet.
What do you call it? Centrifuges or whatever.
Yes.
But, you know, so responding with physical force is really no different. Like, whether you destroy something via electronics or via chemicals or via a nuclear device, you know, measured, obviously, like depleted uranium shells, not like Hiroshima.
Right. So what about the case? So you're talking about the case where somebody sends us a kinetic attack and we send them a cyber attack that results in a kinetic attack. What about the case where somebody offensively strikes with strictly a cyber attack? It doesn't have an effect on a real physical thing. It just like takes down a nation's infrastructure, you know, something that's completely computerized rather than having some sort of physical missile or centrifuge.
I guess it depends on the level of the attack. Like, you know, it'd be maybe considered similar to a trade embargo, like, or a sanction. But I don't know that we should be doing those things unilaterally, you know, just because we want to, or
right.
We don't like because some nation's doing. You know, I think there's diplomatic channels that should be explored first, and I don't think we're in a position where we need to be a bully, you know.
I agree, Matt.
Yeah, I think one of the problems in responding to a cyber attack is always going to be attribution of who's really behind it, because I think that's a lot harder to figure out in the case of a cyber attack compared to, you know, at least traditional kinetic attacks. But, you know, if somebody is attacking us, I think we have a right to respond. I don't see the U.S. being a purely offensive attacker in any circumstance, of, you know, starting a cyber war without, you know, without being a response to some,
right,
you know, either physical or cyber hostility.
Yeah, and this piece out of this snippet out of whatever the National Defense Authorization Act for 2012, you know, it doesn't specify one way or another. It simply says, the Secretary of Defense has the authority to conduct clandestine cyberspace activities in support of military operations, blah, 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 pursuant to this and that. So they don't really say, you know, we're going to do this first strike offensive, but it leaves it open that we could now if we wanted to. Which is interesting. I kind of think we already have, you know, Stuxnet. You know, nobody's going to say that we did it, but really, I mean, come on. We all know we did it. That was totally us. I mean, seriously.
There's smart guys in Israel, too. Smart computer scientists.
There are.
There are a lot of them, actually.
Yeah.
That whole area of the world what is it, Eastern, Western, Eastern Europe, and then a little south, you know, around Israel. Yeah, there's a lot of smart people. Heck, all the viruses that are out in the wild come from Eastern Europe. So there's a lot of smart people over there. So this is pretty interesting. But let's move away from downer stuff into some more consumer markets, such as Dell in the netbook market.
Oh, that's a downer.
I know, right? So two downers, because a couple months ago, Dell said, hey, you know that streak that we made? Yeah, we're not doing that anymore. And now, as of the 17th of December, Dell's like, hey, you know those netbooks we made? Yeah, we're not doing that anymore. So Dell is kind of pulling out of a lot of markets. They're out of the 7-inch tablet, very large phone market, and now they're out of the netbook market. It seems that they're focusing more on consumer machines, laptops and desktops, and they haven't said anything about their server area, so I'm assuming they're staying in the server, the corporate market. But what do you guys think Dell's philosophy is here? Do you think they just decided that they screwed up, Matt?
I think it's the netbook segment's dying industry-wide. We have a 10-inch Atom netbook that's a few years old, and it's kind of handy to grab and take somewhere, but if I were buying a new device, I'd be way more interested in either an iPad or an Ultrabook. The MacBook Air comes in, what, both 10 and 13 or 14-inch?
10 versions. And 13.
Yeah. So all the Ultrabooks I'm seeing so far, you know, on the Windows side have been like 14-inch class, but if those start coming out, you know, in a 10 or 11-inch class to compete with the MacBook Air, that's a lot more appealing to me than, you know, the really dog-slow spinning hard drive netbooks that we've known so far.
Right. Yeah. So you're mostly saying that Dell, or not just Dell, anybody coming out with a netbook, that was a tweener product. Now
right.
that we have tablets that can do so much, we don't need netbooks anymore.
Yeah, I think that's largely the case for most people in the industry. That's how they're seeing it. Yeah.
And I mean, look at Ryan right now. You have a tablet with a keyboard dock.
Right.
That's pretty much a netbook, you know?
It is. I think that, you know, this is the Transformer is a weird class where it's like it's a full-on Android tablet and then has this dock that turns it into a netbook, essentially. Or, you know, I guess it's a netbook.
Oh, it looks like one.
It looks like one. Yeah. It pretty much does everything. It doesn't have nearly as much storage as most of the netbooks, but it's pretty much a netbook. I think you know, netbooks were like a tweener product. I do think that's pretty true. But, you know, they're part of the reason Dell might be doing this is maybe they're seeing that the full-size net laptop and desktop market isn't totally going to burst like everyone's predicting it will. And I think that's the case, I think that's not the case, that it's not going to burst. Because, you know, having a tablet now for several months and a spouse that has an iPad and using other people's iPads and a touchscreen phone, and I still find myself grabbing my laptop and even wanting to go back to a desktop for some, like, for certain kinds of tasks. Like, you know, I can get them, still get them done way faster on a desktop.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest.
It's more comfortable.
Yeah.
I don't have to hold the thing. You know, I can just sit there and type.
Yeah, I use my MacBook for mostly everything. I have an iPad that sits right beside it, but for mostly everything, MacBook. I will gladly wait for the thing to boot up so that I can do things fast with a keyboard rather than use the iPad for those tasks. You know, I'm really only using my iPad now for my photography.
Yeah.
Other than that, it just kind of sits there.
I'd almost equate the interfaces to computers right now, like touchscreens and touchscreens and keyboards and mice, but it's almost like the differences in languages, like not computer languages, spoken languages. Some languages are very verbose and you can say a lot of different things. In other languages, there's more about the inflection. I look at keyboards as like there's this pre-programmed way to interface with the computer. So you can learn that pre-programmed way very quickly. Not very quickly, but once you learn it, you can use it quickly. Where the touchscreen is still like, I've got to look at the screen and I've got to decide. Like, you know, they say about, iOS and all these other, I guess really just iOS, that the whole interface is cohesive. But the one thing that Windows had that that you know, iOS doesn't have is that there were like standard shortcut keys in every program, and a lot of people don't know those shortcut keys, but if you're a power user, you do know them. And you can crush anyone in doing anything on a mouse or a touchscreen with the keyboard still. And I think that's because there's a standard interface.
Right. What do you think it's also an age barrier type thing? Like, you always see these articles or videos that, oh, my six-year-old daughter just picked up my iPad and she's doing stuff. Or a six-month-old. Or, you know, these young kids just pick up a device and they know.
Maybe. Maybe I'm old now.
That's what I'm thinking. Like, am I old too?
If I'm old.
Either way, Dell must realize that we're old because they're getting rid of parts of their market. Well, let's move on to Sony. This one, just a quick mention. We've talked about this before, that Sony, for their PS3, got rid of the install other OS feature, so you can't install Linux or anything else on it. And there's a class action lawsuit filed, which pretty much everybody thought was going to be won. Not by Sony. They thought Sony was going to lose, and they were going to be forced to put this back in. Turns out the judge dismissed it, and Sony does not have to put that back in. I hate Sony. I couldn't think of a better way to state this. But, I mean, have either of you guys had run-ins with either a PS3 wanting to do things that you couldn't do, or just Sony stuff in general?
I haven't, but there's guys at work who are doing, you know, massively parallel supercomputer on a budget kind of things with PS3s. So, yeah, I know people who were doing that.
Yeah, and now if they update, they can't.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I think Sony is definitely one of those companies that tries to control their products more than they should. I won't mention any of their names.
Apple.
But, you know, this is what they're the worst at it, I would argue.
Yeah, they screw up all the time.
Yeah, you know, they're really clumsy and heavy-handed about it.
You know, Sony used to make a lot of great products. And, you know, they arguably they still do make a lot of great products, but they at one time, you know, the Walkman was like the thing to have, and like a Walkman was noticeably better quality than every other like portable tape player made, along with their TVs and their stereos.
Yeah,
and
it used to be when somebody asked me, what do you recommend as a TV? I wouldn't even blink. Sony.
Yeah.
I own a Sony because of that. But now, once that thing dies, I'm going Samsung for a TV. Like, I will not even think about Sony for anything else anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I have an 11-year-old digital receiver, you know, from them for, you know, Surround Sound, and I look at other products and I still can't say, oh, I need to buy this other one, because it was a really good receiver, and it still is a really good receiver. And I wish Sony would just go back to those days of making like quality electronic products.
Yeah, there was a time.
And you know, the PS3 is still an amazing gaming machine. I'm not a gamer, but I know the technical specs of it, and it has that what's the name of that processor?
Core.
Yeah, the core.
Yeah,
I think.
Well, it has like 9 cores,
whatever.
Right?
No, I don't know.
Yeah, it has like 9 cores. There's like 8 processing cores and a controlling core or something. I can't remember the name.
I'm looking it up, so just keep talking.
But it's really cool, and it's really state of the art, and it's super
powerful.
Cell. And it, you know, it is great. It's a great piece of hardware, but it's like, just let it go. Let people do what they want to do with it. It's like, they're not going to like make you bankrupt.
Yeah, I mean, it's a computer.
Yeah.
Like, Sony, give up. It's a computer. The PS3 is a computer. Like, that's just what it is.
I think probably what they might be worried about is the open source community, like, taking this machine over and making an amazing, like, Linux gaming OS, and then, like, all the developers, like, bail, and they don't get any of the royalty money from it.
Yeah, they're afraid of people using it for better things than what they originally could.
Yeah.
I just don't see that as being a huge threat. I mean, I think it's always
It might happen, but it won't, like, ruin them.
Yeah, I think that's going to be, you know, a niche market. And it's going to be people buying the machine and probably buying games anyway. And they may as well, you know, you don't have to go out of your way to help the people who want to, you know, hack the PS3, but you don't have to get in their way either.
Yeah.
And here's one big thing that makes me hate Sony so much more. I just got a new Blu-ray. I bought Cars 2. I liked Cars. I thought I would like Cars 2. I put the DVD or the Blu-ray in. Could not watch it. Forced me to upgrade the freaking OS
of the
PS3.
Oh, okay.
But is that Sony's fault or is that Blu-ray's fault? Because Blu-rays change the encryption often enough that, like, all Blu-ray players need pretty frequent firmware updates.
But that's not the case for all of them. Like, I've had to do this multiple times now, where I've had to update my PS3. It's at least three times over the past year just to watch a Blu-ray. Why?
I have a Blu-ray player, and I gave up on Blu-ray when I bought, like two or three discs in a row that, like, would not play in my Blu-ray player. Like, they'd not like, oh, we're sorry, you have to update the firmware. It would play for, like, a half hour, and then it would, like, pixelate and turn into, like, digital hash. And then you'd have to, like, you know, skip two chapters ahead. And, like, you pick the disc out, there's no visible scratches, fingerprints, or, like, marks on it.
Right.
And it's just like, oh, we're sorry, this disc was manufactured incorrectly.
Yeah, I've only had that problem on Netflix discs.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Which I assume is some microscopic damage that I can't see. Yeah. But it's happened a good bit with those, not so much on the ones that I own.
I often wonder how they get around that. Like, I know the error correction's better on Blu-rays, but there's like seven times the data density in each direction as a DVD or something like that. It's like, how do they get around? I mean, you'd need seven times the... I don't know. I just don't know enough about, like, error correction.
It seems like it's not geographically dispersed enough to deal with the physical damage that the discs get.
Yeah, like, CDs were bulletproof, man. You could, like, spill something on it, put a big gouge in it, and, like, it would, like, always work.
Yeah,
like,
as long as you scratched it up and down. If you scratched it in a circle, you were screwed. But if you scratched it up and down, you're fine.
I've had ones that I thought would never play. Like, I've had ones that have, like, been in my book bag for, like, 3 years, like, when I was in high school. And, like, you know, you pull them out and, like, the dust is embedded into the plastic. And they still play. I'm like, I have no idea how.
Yeah. I guess the final point I wanted to make on this as to why I hate Sony is to bring it back to the original article with the install other OS thing. If you use your PlayStation for another OS to use it as a computer with Linux and also as a Blu-ray player, which I do, you can't. You have to pick one. Because if you want to use install other OS, you have to keep an old OS. If you want to watch your Blu-rays, you are forced to upgrade the OS, lose that feature, just to watch your Blu-rays. So I think Sony kind of picked their battle there and said, people are going to use this more for Blu-ray watching, so we're just going to quote-unquote force them to upgrade their firmware. You know what I mean? So now if people want to use it as a Blu-ray player, they just got rid of install other OS. And that stupid judge got to find out his name and send a bag of burning poo to his house. I mean, seriously, this was the one case we were supposed to win.
Don't put it out with your
parents. It didn't even go to trial, right?
No, it's just gone. He just dismissed it. Speaking of cases that make me mad, this next case, this is ridiculous. If you want to put more oil in that before you turn it on.
Oh.
You can. Nah, there's a push for the. Ryan's messing
with
my.
Does that take memory sticks?
Ryan's messing with my scent bug. Yeah, so just take that off, turn it upside down, shake a few drops out. No more than eight.
All right, it's got a childproof cap on it. Is that really necessary?
Well, I think the stuff's toxic.
Okay.
Sorry, we're
sorry
watching
to interrupt
Ryan.
The show.
It's actually kind of funny. Yeah, put it back in, click it.
This is like when he tells him how to put the BBs in the Red Ryder BB gun.
And then the buttons toward me.
Slowly. We'll spell R.
So now we're going to have some good sense in here.
There we go.
What is that? The smell?
Whorehouse?
Oh, I didn't know I bought that one.
No, I'm sorry. Midnight pomegranates.
Oh, the midnight pomegranates. So much better than the afternoon pomegranates. Gotta tell you. So anyways, back to the court case. We all know, there have even been movies made about it, of the Microsoft antitrust case, which basically made them untie Internet Explorer, their web browser, from the OS. Well, antitrust over. What's Microsoft doing? They're tying the browser back to Windows.
Good for them.
Seriously. I hate them.
No, I mean, good for them.
I mean, really? Do you really think this is a good idea?
Hey, if Apple is allowed to enforce the fact that no one can install another, like buy their machines and install another OS on it and resell it.
You can do resell it.
You can't. That's crap. It's like, no, the hardware's ours.
But that's what makes
you're just allowed
works.
To use it.
How do you change the web browser on an iOS device?
I have a web browser. I have Opera.
But how do you so how do you get other applications to open links in that?
Yeah, exactly.
Jailbreak.
But besides that point, which I think Ryan makes a valid point, but besides that, in the article, it seemed like the evidence claiming that it could not be removed from the Windows 8 preview was simply that they removed the feature, reinstalled the feature, and it still remembered their settings. I don't really see that as evidence that it can't be removed.
Yeah.
Because the your browser settings are stored in the registry. It's a pretty common practice in Windows not to remove software settings when you uninstall software.
Sorry, I'm reading the article.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think that the settings are typically separate. Whether or not they actually uninstall it or just disable it, I don't care. It's like, I've been using IE for a long time, and I mean, it's not my primary browser. I use it occasionally. What's the big deal?
Here's my problem with it. This was the whole Internet Explorer tied to the OS. Having Internet Explorer being used as the file browser, you talk to computer users today, they still don't understand that. That if you open up my computer, that's Internet Explorer. You can browse a web page from your file browser. It's Internet Explorer. That is a huge security risk, being able to have that tied.
I don't think they are tied. I think that they
probably...
They're
the same thing.
There's two separate executables.
Yes, but...
And I think they share a lot of the code. I think they do share a lot of code.
Okay, so Explorer.exe shares all of the code of Internet Explorer to show you browse files on your system. It is IE. You can open up my computer and you can type a web address and it goes to the web without opening a new window. It is IE.
I think Windows would cost twice as much if it didn't. I mean, they would have to spend... No, I'm serious. They'd have to spend twice as much time coding... It's like using a library. I don't see anything wrong with it. I mean, make it secure, yes. They have to make it secure.
Oh, there's that.
But, I think they've done some tests, and IE9 is like the most secure browser, one of the most secure browsers out there now.
I should have put it in here. There was an article that I read.
It smells so good.
Some company did a review of all the browsers and which ones were the most secure. But it sucked because they used Firefox 3, and we're up to 9 now, so... That made me distrust the article anyways. But you're right. IE 9 or 10 did have most features enabled by default for security things. It looked
So is WebKit not used in any other part of, say, OS 10?
Oh, I don't know.
Besides Safari?
I just ripping on Microsoft.
Because I bet that is unlikely.
I know with BlackBerry... I don't know the inner workings backwards and forwards, but I do know that... Most of the or a lot of the apps are browser skinned things, that actually uses the BlackBerry browser behind the scenes to execute the app. Yeah.
Well, iOS does that too.
Yeah.
That's part of the code that if you want a browser, you can just use that widget or whatever they call it in your app and you get Safari built into your app.
See, with iOS it doesn't matter at all because there is no file browser.
That's true. That's true. That's
how they got around it.
That makes
we can't. You can't remove it, right. But we're not going to let you browse files.
But you also can't see anything anyways.
Which I guess Android doesn't either anymore.
That's true.
Unless you get a third-party app.
But yeah, that actually makes me mad whenever I want to pull off log files until I realize that, it's on your laptop whenever you sync it. It always makes me mad that I can't browse files on my iPhone until I find out, there's another way. It's an annoying way, but there's another way. So, whatever. I still don't like this.
Yeah, the thing that I don't like about this is a little bit of a rant about the whole no file browser thing. It's like someone just decided that file cabinets are a bad idea. I'm going to make you a home office, but there's no file cabinets. You have to put your papers in this closet, and there's this magic gnome who gives you the right paper when you ask for it. That's pretty much what these operating systems do now.
But isn't that exactly what Windows 7 does with libraries? That's what a library is.
No, that's just an aggregation of directories.
Yeah.
But it's still the magic thing. You put it in there. You don't know where it goes. You don't care where it goes. And it magically gives you what you want from where you put it.
If you use it...
Not really.
If you use it out of the box, it's kind of like that. It just goes into this library. But you can if you have three or four partitions, three different disks on your computer...
If you configure it.
You can you can add a folder to your library and then tell it where you want it to save.
Right.
You can still kind of control it. And it's native. It's native to the OS. It's not like some hack you need to do.
Right, right.
Yeah, and I think even if you just open up your pictures library in Explorer, it shows you all the different places it's drawing files from.
Mm-hmm.
I don't use Windows 7 enough to
It does.
There's not a whole lot that's hidden in that mechanism.
Yeah, so I kind of agree with Ryan. I don't know why they decided, why some magic person decided we will no longer show you files.
Oh, I think it makes sense from the standpoint of trying to develop new user-friendly interfaces. I mean, who hasn't had, you know, a grandmother or somebody who puts all their files at the root of the C drive?
That's true.
I think it's trying to simplify that complexity for people.
Okay. And not having a file system at all, you mean?
Not exposing the file system to the user. Yeah,
yeah, but I think that really what happens in the background is that all the files are in the root of C and the software just takes care of it for you, which I guess is one way of doing it. But it's like, what if I want to organize my file by year? You know, they don't give you the control. Like, I still have not seen an app, and even some of the file browsing apps that are like part of an OS now, they don't give you like the control and the searchability to like find something you're looking for. You know, they haven't gone full metadata to where you just fully describe the file with metadata so that you can search for it later.
Yeah, it's really hard.
Or they do,
Windows.
And then the search engine doesn't search the metadata that they give you. And all of these operating systems, I think, are guilty in some way. They all have little things where maybe you can search for it, but you can't organize it. And maybe that's just like the, you know, control freak in me that wants to organize my files.
Yeah, I can see your point on the desktop. I don't think we're there yet from anything that I've seen. But on something like an iPhone, I certainly haven't missed having a file system. It's just never been something I've thought about. I really wish I could browse a file system on this.
See, I have wished that on my iPhone. So what if we take your original idea, keep the interfaces the way they are, you know, Android, iOS, whatever, user-friendly, nobody has to know the file system's there. Give us the choice of an app that is a file browser that we can get if we want to.
Just put it on there and like don't expose the icon.
Like it doesn't affect anybody. You still use it the way you use your Android or iOS stuff now. But for those of us who want to look at our files, we can.
What's your use case? Like I'm not getting it. What files do you have on there that you need to browse in a file system?
For me, I have wanted log files for applications to diagnose crashes. And that's
I think we're getting a little out there in terms of...
Well, I mean...
right. If the point is to make a user-friendly device, you shouldn't be having crashes that people need to delve through log files to get to.
But there are. I mean, we've all had applications crash on our devices. They just randomly close. You don't know why. I actually helped Hootsuite debug their Twitter app because it crashed all the time. And they finally figured out through my logs that it was an error on their server code. You know, like that's just something I wish I could have got my logs, looked at it, said, oh, this is why.
Like, why isn't that just sent to the developer?
I have no idea.
You know, when something crashes.
No idea.
Well, I'm surprised no one's pointed out the fact that this whole thing is just, for what it really is, it's just an attack on the entire tech support industry. Like, they know that tech support costs are a big part of their problem, or have been, or, you know, their balance sheets, and they want to reduce that.
Well, you know who else makes mistakes? All the time. Facebook. Specifically, Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, probably not him at all, but I'm sure he has to approve this stuff. But anyways, now Facebook is under a privacy watch for the next 20 years.
20 years?
The FTC is watching them for the next 20 years to make sure they don't do any of the grave privacy errors that they've been doing in the past year or two.
That's like five millennia in internet time.
I was going to say, is Facebook even going to be around in 20 years? Like, really, 20 years?
Yeah, that's
it'll either
time.
Be gone or it will be everything.
That's true.
We'll just live as virtual brains in Facebook.
When we wake up, we will plug in Facebook. Or we might not even wake up. We'll quote-unquote wake up.
It will be the Matrix.
Yeah, we'll be in the Matrix. But I like this, and at the same time, I think this is ridiculous. Like, 20 years is kind of ridiculous, but I do like that somebody is finally watching over them, making sure they don't screw things up like they've been doing. Have you guys seen this happen? Like, I think the last time it happened, I mentioned how I was in New York one time, and my parents know that I post all the time. I mean, you guys are friends with me on multiple social networks. You know I post all the time.
Yes, so unfortunately.
So if you stop seeing me post, I'm probably dead. And that's what my parents thought, because I was in New York, and they haven't seen a post from me for, like, an entire day that I was there. So they called me, like, freaking out, you know, are you okay? And it turned out that day, like, over the night, Facebook turned on some privacy setting that set every post you publish to private unless you go in and change the setting. Like, that's one way that it hurt me. It didn't really hurt me, but...
That's actually, like, the opposite of what they usually do.
Right. Normally, they expose stuff.
Right.
Yeah, but, like, just the changes that they make on a whim that affect everybody.
Yeah, I don't think this is their fault, but for... I think it's just because I didn't understand what was going on. But one time, just to pull someone's leg, I wrote a post that was visible only to them because I was sort of making a joke about them, right? And I didn't realize it, but then for like the next week, everything I posted was only visible to them because I didn't realize that that would establish a new default.
Right. I did that. I now have a default now that does a similar thing. Yeah. It's actually kind of... Yeah, I don't like how it sticks like that.
Yeah.
Because I
yeah.
always forget these things.
Right.
Okay, so let's move on to some mobile news. I'm sorry, I'll cut that short because I don't have a mobile sound. That was just a vintage news sound. Oh, why don't I have that?
Nokia.
Oh, man. What about...
that's not mobile, that's hardwired.
Yeah.
It's modem. It starts with the same two letters.
Modulator, demodulator.
So anyways, I will promise to come up with a better sound. So this this first article is just kind of a little jab that Apple... If you haven't been living under a rock, you've probably heard of the lawsuits that Apple's been flinging against people like HTC, prohibiting them from selling their products in other countries. So what do you guys think about these whole things? Personally, I think the prohibit from selling products is a little over the top. But for the reasons that they state, I do think they kind of have a point with the trade dress and everything.
I always thought that the point of these patent portfolios was mutually assured destruction and they wouldn't be used.
Yeah, the difference between like the United States in 1970, 1980 and Apple is that Apple pushed the button.
Apple did push the button.
they had this war chest and they decided to use it.
Yeah, like I mean, of course, I'm an Apple fanboy, so I'm going to be on their side. But I do think they have a point with the whole trade dress thing that, you know, when Apple came out with the iPhone, it totally changed the whole cell phone paradigm. Now other people are coming out with things, specifically HTC, that looked and used the exact same icons that the iPhone did. You know, things that look exactly the same. And I think that's wrong. So I think they had a good point in suing them because of that. I wish other companies would do what Apple did originally and just come out with something that's totally better. Like, make it different, make it better. Like, why does everybody have to copy the iPhone?
I mean... I do think that some of the Samsung stuff that, you know, was it the Galaxy Nexus or the S?
Was it Samsung or was it HTC? One of them was like identical.
I think it was the Samsung Galaxy S. Okay. Was the one that they...
Samsung's the big copier.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Which they're also the big supplier, right? They're the ones that supply...
They're the hardware supplier.
Yeah. For the screen, at least.
Yeah.
And, excuse me. The more that this plays out in the courts, like, the... You know, Microsoft's no, what do you call it? They're not innocent either. They've instead of like litigating, they've sort of like wink, wink, nudge, nudge, better sign this agreement or we're going to take you to court.
Right.
And they've won over most people that way. To what degree? And there's been a lot of rumor that their patents are actually pretty weak compared to some of these other ones. Nonetheless, they're doing it. Apple's doing it. And... I don't agree with any of it. The more that this plays out in the courts, the more that I'm in favor of no intellectual property protection at all by the state. I don't think that the state... I mean, really what these end up being are state-protected monopolies for 20 years. And what ends up happening is they just lobby Congress to extend the time period. And it's whether it's the design of a product or music or books or whatever, they just get wrapped up in somebody's like patent or copyright portfolio and they protect it forever. See, and it never goes to the public domain.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you on that. I mean, I've said before on the show my cockamamie idea that if somebody comes out with something and somebody else comes out with the same thing that they found out a way to do it better and cheaper, good for them. You can't sue them because they found a better way to do it. But in the case of this, nobody has found a better way to do it. You know, the iPhone consistently wins on user polls of usability and everything. Nobody's been better than the way the iPhone originally did it, but everybody's doing it.
Maybe Windows Mobile.
I was going to bring up that case that they're the only ones.
They're at least doing something different.
Yeah, that's my point. They did it different. Everybody else just copies the first one that came out.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that, you know, Microsoft sort of doing a clean room project, in essence. They wanted something like completely ground up different.
Right.
And arguably, it's a great interface. Don't get me wrong. And I don't think it's probably going to sound bad, but it's not popular, and that's not fair. You know, in like they played by the rules, and it's not popular. And I think the reason it's not popular is simply due to like perception. You know,
I think part of it is the late start. You know, in terms of the users, but also from what I'm hearing, they're not getting a lot of support from the carriers. The carriers are in love with Android. It's basically free to them. They can put whatever they want on it, as we'll discuss later.
Yeah.
And Microsoft isn't quite as easy to play with, I think, for the carriers.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate. I mean, I agree with you that Microsoft deserves a better shot than they're getting.
Yeah.
I do agree with that. On the same token, I don't like the Windows Mobile. I play with it in Best Buy, and I don't know. I can't tell you why. I just don't like. I don't like the design of it. Nothing to do with functionality. I just don't like the way it looks and the way words cross screens when you're switching screens. And
there's a little bit on that aesthetics part. Yeah. That's a common complaint that there's like no, you know, you don't see everything on a screen. But that the whole concept around Windows Phone is that this screen is a window onto a bigger picture,
right?
And that's what you're navigating through, is this bigger picture. So,
but as far as what it can do,
yeah,
it can do everything that a BlackBerry or an Android or an iOS device can do.
Yeah.
Like, and there are people who like the appearance of it and the interface. So
right.
You know, in terms of diversity, that's great, right? You like one thing, other people like something else.
Exactly. Great. Yeah, I just wish that everybody would do what Microsoft did and think outside of the box and come out with something that, holy crap, blows away Apple. Why hasn't anybody done that in the past 5 years?
Well, in terms of this patent suit, isn't the specific claim in regards to like turning phone numbers into touchable links?
Oh, I have no idea.
Like, so if somebody texts you a telephone number, you can tap on it and it dials?
I don't even know the specifics, but I mean, I know BlackBerry has had that for years. Like, it's not a touch; it's a click on a button.
Well, see, that's totally different.
Right.
And the outcome I read is that, you know, Android needs to like make it a double tap or something like that instead of a tap, just to not...
It's technically anything. Okay. Phone numbers, emails, anything one document that you can click and it opens up another one.
Yeah. But so to me, that's the internet. That's hypertext linking. Like, they have no prior art on that at all.
Yeah, that's a pretty obvious idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing I read recently, I think just on Twitter, about patents is patents come from the mindset that ideas are precious and implementation is easy.
Yeah.
And that's not the right mental model for a lot of software development.
Right.
That there's a lot of ideas that are pretty freaking obvious, and you just need to implement them and put them together into some decent whole.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually really like that.
Yeah. I mean, and they're not patenting processes. They're patenting they're patenting an idea. Like, I could see them totally patenting a way, possibly. This would be maybe slightly more acceptable to me. If they found a really
it's like an algorithm.
Yeah, like an ingenious way to do it, maybe, that they could patent that ingenious way of doing it. Like, oh, this is how we did it, whatever. But I don't even see that really flying in software because, well, I mean, the Supreme Court said that it's, you know, algorithms are just math problems, but no one's paid attention to that in the last 10 years anyway, so it doesn't even matter.
Yeah, and the next article I just want to bring up, because it's nothing more than a sticking point, is that 92% of all online mobile purchases come from the iPhone and the iPad.
And this is referring to like buying merchandise, not apps and stuff like that.
Yes,
right?
Yes, purchases at like Amazon or, you know, whatever. I just put that in there just as a stick, because I thought I was going to end the other article saying something of how Apple was great, and then I could bring up this article, but I kind of didn't do that. So
they're saying that. So that you're saying, like, if I went online and like I bought a new refrigerator on Amazon, that would be included in this?
Yeah, they're saying that the average, it's the third paragraph down, the average order from an iOS device is $123, while the average order from an Android device is $101. So they're saying, based on all shopping sessions between April and December 2011, iOS, iPad, iPhone, whatever, were the most. 92% of shopping happened from an iOS device.
Yeah, so this is the basic Android users are cheap. Apple users.
Oh, I wasn't even going to go
spend
there.
Spend freely.
I guess that is the only obvious thing that you could take away from this, because Android is in more people's hands.
Right, right. And yeah. I mean, that's definitely been the story for like app purchases right. and media purchases and stuff like that.
Wow. You think but I would have thought of that, considering I'm always down on Android.
But it is a little bit funny to apply that to purchase of tangible items. But it kind of fits with an impression I have that a lot of Android users have this vague idea that Android buyers, I should say, mm-hmm. have this vague idea that they want a smartphone, but they don't really want a smartphone.
It's just the cool thing.
They don't want to do anything with it.
It's the cool thing to get, and it's the cheaper of the two, which isn't always the case, but it can be because
and it'll be pushed more by the carriers because they do better with them.
Right, it's almost like you don't have a choice. You know, how many quote unquote dumb phones can you buy? Two? Yeah. Everything is a smartphone nowadays.
Yeah, so they can sell you a data plan, whether you need it or not, all that good stuff.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
So I mean that could be that could just be a that definitely I mean but what this says to carriers and retailers and everything else is that, well, you know, iOS is the way to go because this is where we make our money.
Right.
But
yeah,
it's not a prescription, right? If you sold twice as many iPhones, that doesn't magically mean those people would buy twice as much stuff.
Right.
I think it's telling you something about the types of people who choose to buy the different devices.
I understand that, but I don't know that I don't know that the people selling these devices do. You know, or the people like it that are making the decisions at these companies that are the products that are selling the products.
But maybe it tells you something about how to spend your marketing dollars, you know, on ad networks and stuff like that.
On ad networks. Make your first mobile page to market be the iOS compatible version rather than something else.
I mean, I'm the type of person, like, I don't do a whole lot of purchasing on my phone or my tablet. Like, I do all of my purchasing on my laptop because typically I want to, like, search a million websites and find the best deal, and that's impossible to do on a small screen.
Yeah, you have, like, 18 tabs of reviews. And,
I'm normally with you guys. Like, 99% of my shopping is done on a computer.
Yeah.
But I have used the Amazon mobile app and the eBay mobile app when I'm not home. I've been at my parents' house.
I have
something
monitor
goes wrong.
Auctions, yeah.
Yeah, like something goes wrong with my parents' computer, bring up Amazon, bam, just bought the part, it'll be here in 2 days. Like, I've done that a bunch of times.
Yeah. Amazon and eBay have pretty slick mobile apps, too.
Yeah. Most of my eBay usage has just been to monitor a purchasing decision I already made. Like,
yeah, there's that.
And honestly, it's like, oh, did I win or lose? But anyway.
So let's talk.
I always like phrasing, like, buying something on eBay as winning. Like,
well, it is winning.
It's less like, it's, you know, like, maybe you feel a little guilty about spending money on something you don't need, but like with like eBay, it's like, oh, I won that.
That's part of the scam.
It might be.
I read that criticism of eBay a long time ago when it was the new thing, right? Because it dupes people into getting this euphoric rush of winning.
Yeah.
When really winning means you were willing to pay more for this thing than anyone else in the world.
Yeah.
But
less than Amazon sells for it for.
But it's true.
It could still be winning because there are those people out there that use sniping applications that will get you with 1 second left where you as a human can't do that. So there is a little bit of winning in that you beat out these people with these applications.
Well,
that
you beat
snipe.
Out you beat out the people that are stupid and like bid real early.
Right. I mean, I'll say I do have a Java app that is an eBay sniper for things that I really want.
Yeah, I snipe. If there's something expensive, I snipe it. If it's something like kind of like more of a commodity or that, you know, it's the same price everywhere.
Big deal.
Yeah, whatever.
So anyways, remember back when AT&T said, hey, we're going to buy T-Mobile? Remember that?
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, now they said, hey, we're not going to buy T-Mobile.
Good.
Is it because the FTC basically said, hey, you're not going to buy T-Mobile?
Well, there was a lot of that. There was a lot of Department of Justice and FTC weighing in saying this is bad, you shouldn't do this. And now it wasn't that they were stopped from buying T-Mobile. They basically figured out that we're going to be stopped, so we'll just exit this on our own.
Yeah, so you can be stopped quickly and cheaply, or you can be stopped slowly and expensively.
Right, and they chose the quick and cheap. Let's just kill this right now. So back whenever we predicted doomsday that AT&T and T-Mobile would merge, not going to happen. So all of you T-Mobile customers, you're still good with your hot girl commercials and your cell phone data plans.
That's the same reason I have all my domains at GoDaddy, by the way.
We are going to be talking about GoDaddy. Boy, are we going to talk about GoDaddy. Not about the girls, though.
The domain registrar's name who shall not be named.
Yeah. So on that note, let's move into our security section. I really like that one. So our first... we basically have two topics under security, even though if you're reading our topic list, there are a lot of articles. It's really just two topics. First one we alluded to earlier about carriers putting stuff on cell phones. So we all knew, we all kind of knew if you have a cell phone, people are watching you. You know, they're seeing what you do on your phone. Well, now it's no longer just us wondering whether that's happening. It is 100% fact. Carriers know literally every single thing you do on your phone, every keystroke, every swipe of your finger, everything you do on your phone is being monitored, or in some carriers' cases, has been monitored for the past couple of years with a company called Carrier IQ and their software that has been in pretty much every cell phone OS. I mean, I know I'm going on a limb saying every, but you guys aren't correcting me. Kevin, you're really wrong. So let's just assume most cell phone OSs.
It's common. I mean, I think it's common.
Yeah. I think there were some carriers that have never used it.
And Sprint, actually, the first article says that they are now disabling it. I mean, what are you guys' thoughts on Carrier IQ when this... Because this came out a couple months ago that Carrier IQ had been discovered and what it was capable of doing.
I think it really makes that iOS location cache not such a big deal, doesn't it?
Yeah, really. Yeah, so Matt's referring to the old thing, plug into your iPhone and get the map of every place you've ever been with your iPhone showing up on your screen. Yeah, not so big of a deal whenever you think that most carriers have seen every keystroke that you've typed. Like, this just, when this first came out, I didn't know what to say. Like, I was mad and I don't know.
But have they really seen all the keystrokes you've typed? My understanding was that in some cases they were being logged in log files, like the very same sort of Java logs you were trying to access on your file system earlier.
I
thought that what was being transmitted back to the carriers was probably much less than that.
Well, the problem was that it could be everything was logged. Whether or not the carrier chose to extract it from your phone or not, that was a carrier by carrier basis.
Is there any evidence that any carriers have been nearly that intrusive?
I do not know. Ryan?
I don't know that either. I was just reading the Wikipedia article on Carrier IQ. I don't know a whole lot about it. I mean, I basically knew that it was like, they were tracking what you did on your phone, not only where you've been, but what you've done on it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, in some ways, this is a little bit like customer feedback sort of things. Like, even on desktops, they want to, like, see how you use the software, monitor it, report bugs, find out what
happens. And that's
how
they're trying to smooth this over.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that it could be used for nefarious purposes. I don't like the idea of this at all unless they explicitly ask you at the beginning, or maybe even like, I don't know.
Well, think of when you first install Microsoft Office. What's one of the first things that pop up? Do you want to participate in our customer experience program? Yes or no?
No.
You click no, it doesn't send stuff back.
Right.
This just happened. And as our second article points out, where the EFF reverse engineered how it works, it's not just that data goes from your phone to the carrier. Carrier IQ is a software package. It's also a company.
Yeah.
The data from your phone, everything that you've ever done, goes from your phone to the company Carrier IQ.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the company, your cell phone carrier, Verizon, whatever, can ask for your data.
Yeah.
So the problem, sure, it's a problem that Verizon, Sprint, whatever, have this data. The bigger problem is nobody knows what the Carrier IQ company is going to do with it. Are they going to sell your data, that middleman? You know, that's really the bigger problem that the EFF points out, is there's this middleman nobody knows about.
Plus any data security concerns.
Was anything encrypted? Yeah.
I mean, Matt and I have had discussions on this in the past, like sort of just about privacy in general, you know, and I think that, you know, I mean, I have maybe a slightly unfounded fear about privacy and like what people can do with the data that is tracked about you. I've even taken it as far as like maybe, you know, getting rid of Facebook and not even using Gmail anymore. Like, to the, you know, I don't know. I mean, Google definitely is a little more, I think they're more honest about what they have on you. But sometimes I just wonder, it's not really that I think that they would use it purposely against me. It'd be, you know, if I were framed for a crime or something like that, that maybe the data could actually be used to prove that I didn't do the crime. But I think that if somebody has the willpower to frame me for a crime, they're going to be able to modify this easily modifiable data. I think I'd be happy if the courts would say this electronic data is not usable in court. It's not as good as an eyewitness.
Right, because think about who's going to be on the jury to convict you. People who aren't as technologically savvy as you and I or Matt, who can, you know, have that probable cause or beyond a reasonable doubt,
yeah,
that, you know, yes, you were here because this data looks like you were there.
And I just think it's too easy. I think it's too easy to modify data and make it say what you want it to say because of its fluid nature. Like, if you alter a piece of paper, there's obvious evidence. There's forensics there. The forensics in the digital realm, I don't think, are anywhere near what they are in the real-world realm. That's just my opinion. I'm not schooled in forensics.
No, I mean, I'm going to mostly agree with you on that, you know, unless you have software like Tripwire or sanity-checking software. How are you going to know if stuff has been modified?
Right.
Really?
Well, and there's a lot about, you know, they say about, oh, you can detect when there's, you know, there's been overwrites on a hard drive and stuff like that. But I, you know, this is not to get too far off subject, but I got really interested in the Ray Grecar case, you know, from Penn State, not to stick a knife in anyone's wounds or anything, you know, but I'm saying, like, Matt's wearing a Penn State shirt. Anyway, I got really interested in, I looked into like data restoring, things like that. And from what I've read, data restoration and being able to, you know, like detect when a bit was overwritten and see stuff when it's not as good as they say that it is. Like, it's not like it is in anywhere in the movies, and that type of forensics isn't there. So if somebody did change the data on your, you know, in your phone to say you were somewhere when you weren't, then I just don't think that.
I guess that's one thing that we kind of take for granted, that we know the stuff that happens in movies isn't real, but other people might think that, yeah, they can track us. I've seen it done in TV all the time. Yeah. And you're right. It's not like that. That's not how it works.
Right. And I think if you wanted to go change paper records, you'd have to get into a building and there'd be witnesses that somebody entered the building. And it just, there's the level of complexity of getting there is like way higher than it is in the, in digital, you know, electronics.
Yeah, and anyway, just to insert here real quick, AT&T and Sprint were the biggest U.S. carriers doing this.
Yeah, Verizon actually denies all involvement with Carrier IQ.
And Vodafone, Three, and Orange are the European ones that used Carrier IQ. Matt, it looked like you were just about ready to say something before I barged in.
Yeah, I guess regarding the accuracy or the degree to which digital data is prone to tampering kind of depends on who has the opportunity, right? Like, you're talking about Ray Grecar. It was his own personal hard drive. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's his work computer, but it was in his own possession, and right, he could tamper with it as he pleased. If I'm accused of a crime and, you know, there's prosecutors prosecuting me and they subpoena data from Google or Verizon or something like that, my expectation is that Google or Verizon doesn't have a dog in the fight, and they'll deliver accurate data to the best of their ability, because why would they try to either tamper with the data to make me look guilty or make me look innocent?
Well, I'm not even sure that it would be Google or Verizon doing it. It could be the, you know, the people involved in the prosecution. I just, yeah, you know, if they're just delivering data to you, unless they're going to have somebody from Google come and swear.
Well, they should, in my opinion.
They should,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know. To me, the digital world is like, it's like photoshopping a picture. Like, you can fool a buttload more people with digital photos than you can with...
Yeah, but I mean, you gave credence to eyewitness testimony, and from what I've read, eyewitness testimony is not very accurate at all. People people's memories fill in blanks.
It isn't.
And people have excessive confidence in their recollections and stuff like that. So I don't see how that's a very good
standard of comparison. And I've read similar things, but courts typically require multiple eyewitnesses to convict somebody.
Yeah, but they can very easily be influenced by the prosecution as well. It would be easier for a prosecutor to influence two witnesses than to tamper with data from Verizon.
Than to hire a hacker hitman to go hack into your phone. Yeah.
So I see the concerns, but to me it's not obvious that it's any that the, this wealth of data is any worse for us than 1950s.
Well,
in terms of the accuracy of prosecutions and things like that,
I think the old saying goes: power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that these companies, and with the current laws in the United States, like Patriot Act and other things. There's a lot
they
of power.
They now have absolute power.
They do. And I'm afraid of that. I'm way more afraid of what they have the power to change about what your online record says about you than, 20 years ago.
And we've just been talking about carriers, Verizon, Google, whatever. What about this Carrier IQ company? What if people could hack into them, change your data, so the next time your carrier requests it from them, they get corrupt data? Mm-hmm. What if Carrier IQ sells it to other people? How does this affect us marketing-wise? We're always worried about people selling our personal data. They could be doing that. We don't know. So I'm just... I don't like the middleman. I kind of realized that people were looking at things for diagnostic purposes. I mean, iOS 5 now, you have to answer yes or no to sending diagnostic stuff back to Apple whenever you install the OS. So they're up front and they tell you. I kind of realized that was happening, just not to this extent. Mm-hmm. Of what Carrier IQ was doing. So if you're on AT&T, they're still doing it.
I mean, along the same lines, you talk about the Microsoft stuff, and you want to improve the user experience. And if you read the Windows 7, I'm sorry, the Windows 8 blog, I'm trying to think.
Building Windows 8. Steven Sonoski.
Yeah, it's a really neat blog, and they get lots of telemetry from people who have participated in this. And I think that's a pretty neat upside to things. People can decide for themselves whether the privacy concerns outweigh their contribution to that.
Right.
But I think in terms of being a computer user, it's neat that the developers have access to information on how people really use their products.
Yeah, I've got no problem with them collecting statistics. And I think, in aggregates, those are much different than
You type this keystroke into this web page.
Or, an accurate GPS log of everywhere you've been for the last 3 months. That's that's just beyond, they need to anonymize that data. I know you can't do it perfectly, but there's got to be a better way.
I think this is a case with almost everything we've talked about today. There's got to be a better way. Nobody's figured it out
yet. Like, for instance, one way of doing it on an iPhone is if you want that feature so that it locates you, then what it should do is it should store 10 GPS logs, and you never know, and it just randomly creates 9 other ones that you can't. Only the OS has the key that knows which one's the right one or something. That sort of thing would be right there. Would be enough for me to be like, okay, now no one can really know for sure where I was. Like, they know I could be one of these 10 possible places, but it, I don't know. Maybe that's.
I bet it's harder than that.
It might be.
Right, you do something like that, and then you tie one point based on, eyewitness or some other record, right?
Yeah, I guess.
And that tells you which of the 10 is the right one, something like that. It's probably very hard to do right.
Yeah.
Because they try to anonymize things like people's Netflix subscriptions and stuff like that, and smart people find ways to de-anonymize it by correlating with IMDb reviews and stuff like that. I mean, all sorts of real-life anonymization schemes have been broken because people want to show that there's ways to break those schemes.
Right. Yeah. There are people out there who do nothing but try to break things like that just to show that it can be broken.
Right. Right. Same with census data. If the census block gets too small, they don't report certain data. And there's people who do the same things and show, even though you reported this, we can still track that to households. Same idea. Right. It's hard to do right, which is what makes it hard.
Which means it shouldn't be done at all. They shouldn't track us.
So many companies doing so many bad things. Such as the worst law ever. Or I guess it's not really a law yet, but it probably is going to be because people in Congress are idiots. And that is SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, or what used to be called Protect IP, which really was an acronym, believe it or not. That's a lot of letters, and they found out a way to make it an acronym. I don't know what it is. I don't care, because this law sucks. But basically, it is a law that gives the United States the ability to literally break the internet in order to, quote-unquote, stop piracy. Thoughts?
Well, it's not even just the United States, right? It's basically the content owners can make a request which is realistically going to be acted upon immediately. It's not necessarily the U.S. government getting involved at all.
Well, it's the law being passed in the U.S. and most people realizing that most internet content is housed in the U.S., so therefore you're pretty much breaking the whole internet by having this law passed in the U.S.
Well, right, but what he's saying is that it's not just the U.S. I mean, it's a U.S. law, yes, passed in the U.S., right. It breaks the whole internet, but what it allows to happen that's even worse is that a content owner, meaning like Universal Music, can just make an accusation, no court tribunal, nothing, and have a website taken down.
Oh, right. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah.
So the breakage occurs without the due process and judicial protections we usually associate with...
Yes, this is the Internet's Patriot Act.
A legitimate government.
Yeah. This is Patriot Act for the Internet. You don't need evidence. You just say, hey, this guy pirated my thing, and then because of this law...
But only for the purposes of protecting copyrighted information, which is bullshit. I mean, copyright is just government, you know, mandated or government protected monopoly anyways. Like, we've all agreed that we think we should have copyright. Like, it's just like a common agreement. That doesn't mean that it's like a natural law, though. You know, like, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's called out in the Constitution for a specific purpose, right? To promote the useful arts, copyright shall be extended for a limited period of time, something like that. So it's explicitly not a natural law. It's something we enacted for a specific purpose, and it should only be used to the degree that it promotes that purpose,
right?
Of facilitating people and pursuing the arts.
I'd argue it's like at this point, like a combination of this act and our current like copyright laws. I gave examples of like some of these content companies taking down websites of content they don't even own, like just because they don't want competing content or whatever reason. I don't know what reason.
And it's not just taking down. What a lot of the internet creators and people like Dan Kaminsky, the guy who found the big DNS bug of a couple years ago, is that it literally, they are breaking the internet in order to do this. They are breaking DNS records for certain things that they think have copyrighted material, so that when you query, you get back a bad response or no response for these places. Like, this law is allowing content owners to break the internet in order to protect their copyrights.
Well, I think even more severe than the DNS breakage is that it allows them to cut off the funding sources.
Mm-hmm.
So your credit card processor stops sending you money, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's one example that came up, which is not on the show notes yet, but it involves this company called Weebly. I don't know if you know them, but they are a web hosting service. They let you build a website using a simple GUI on the web. It's very easy to use. My wife happens to use it for her personal sites and for her small business. And Weebly's DNS is served by GoDaddy.
Oh.
Yeah. So even before any of these new laws were passed, what happened, and this came from Weebly's CEO on a blog post in the context of this discussion, is he got a call from GoDaddy because somebody somewhere complained that one of the 1 million sites hosted by Weebly posted a negative customer review of his business. And in response to this, GoDaddy was pulling all of Weebly's DNS records.
Awesome.
And that was happening in 10 minutes.
And so, to further go on that, the next article was the list of people supporting it. GoDaddy is one of them, the supporters of SOPA. And because of that, people are now staging revolts. Just, I don't know the updated number, but as of a couple days ago, over 72,000 domains have been moved from GoDaddy to other services because of this.
Yeah.
Like, people are revolting against GoDaddy for their support of this and moving their domains.
I mean, GoDaddy was not only their supporter, I guess they helped draft the bill. Some of the language in it.
I didn't realize that.
And I also read, I don't know how true this is, I saw a headline and I didn't have time to read it because I saw it was a little while ago before I came down to the show. And it said something about that GoDaddy was in some way exempt in this act too from some of these things. Like they themselves would be exempt from these complaints against them.
Oh, nice.
Well, so, one of the act's provisions is basically, if you're the DNS provider and you get a complaint from the copyright holders, you have a safe harbor provision to respond to that complaint. So if somebody says, hey, this site has our copyrighted stuff, and you pull their DNS records in response to that complaint, nothing bad can happen to you, no matter how wrong that accusation was. So any DNS provider's lawyers are going to say every time you get a complaint, pull the records, because you have the safe harbor provision. That is the safe way to do. You will not get in trouble for doing that.
All right.
Yeah, and I mean, look at some of the companies that support this. So we've already said GoDaddy. A lot of them that you realize, ESPN, CBS. And there's some on here that you just wouldn't think. I mean, maybe you would. NFL, MLB, football, baseball. L'Oreal, the cosmetic company. Really?
A lot of fashion-type companies are very concerned about copyright and counterfeit goods, which is why companies like eBay are scared, because they're worried that Guess or Chanel or somebody is going to knock off eBay because somebody's selling fake purses.
Yep, Revlon, Tiffany's,
the Council of State Governments,
Pfizer, the Viagra makers. Well, they make other things, but Visa, Warner Music, Ultimate Fighting Championship, the UFC. Really? I mean, this list, it's in the show notes.
When you're charging, $80 a pay-per-view, I bet they get pirated all the time.
Yeah, seriously.
Interestingly enough, the Fraternal Order of Police also supports it. And Hyperion, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, and so we mentioned the revolt from GoDaddy customers. And actually, it's not in the show notes, but the CEO of GoDaddy came out. And it was funny how he did it. I don't know if either of you guys saw this article. He came out not to say, hey, we're no longer for SOPA. He just came out to say, hey, we don't have a comment anymore. We're not saying we're for or against. So that resulted in more people pulling their domains from GoDaddy. But GoDaddy is prohibiting that. I forget. I didn't bookmark the article. Oh, I might have it in my Google Reader. But they're breaking the way DNS transfers, zone transfers work, so that people can't transfer their domains from GoDaddy.
I heard they were corrupting DNS records, too, on the way out or something like that.
I want to know if this is actual resistance or if they're just, overloaded by the sheer
idiots.
Exodus.
They don't do it well.
They can't handle
it. Well, I mean, if suddenly you have 1,000 times your normal number of domains leaving you a day, maybe something breaks,
And I mean, really, have either of you used GoDaddy or attempted to use it? Have you seen their website? It's pretty bad.
Yeah, I went to it. Actually, every year my renewal comes up on my website, and I was like, I wonder if I can find cheaper hosting. Not really cheaper, just more features and more data and more bandwidth, really, is what I'm looking for the same price. And they're cheap. They are cheap. And I looked them, but I never pulled the trigger. But yeah, their website is it's one of the worst websites ever.
Okay, so I did put the article on my Google Reader about GoDaddy blocking zone transfers. So I'm going to see if I can bring it up real quick. But this is fairly ridiculous. I mean, I too, every year, oh crap. I hope KevinSlonka.com isn't out for sale right now, because I totally forgot to
listeners,
pay for it.
On your marks, get set.
I'm going to do it before this show gets uploaded, so you will not have a chance. Holy crap, I forgot about that. So let's see. Oh, so this is kind of like the apology letter. Oh, they are delaying the transfer process, which goes strictly against ICANN rules. So yeah, whether or not it's because they can't handle it or whether it's retaliation, they're delaying anybody who tries to remove their domain from GoDaddy. GoDaddy has confirmed they have unblocked the queries. Whatever. Hate GoDaddy. But a cool thing. Now, did either of you guys get a chance to look at the next article, the YouTube video? Because it looks really good. And by really good, I mean it looks CG. But I'm going to play it now. It's only like 2 minutes long. Apparently, Joe Biden, vice president, is anti-SOPA.
Now, there are some who have a different view, as you all know. They seek an international legal instrument that would lead to exclusive government control over internet resources, institutions, and content, and national barriers on the free flow of information online. But this, in our view, would lead to a fragmented internet, one that does not connect people, but divides them, a stagnant cyberspace, not an innovative one, and ultimately, a less secure cyberspace, with less trust among nations.
So this is a clipped up feed. So the next question, how do you feel about the entrepreneurs trying to build new entertainment?
They should not be prevented from sharing their innovations with global consumers simply because they live across a national frontier. That's not how the internet should ever work, in our view. Not if we want it to remain the space where economic, political, and social exchanges can flourish.
So how does he feel about the changing technological and legislative framework governing the internet?
We have an expression in our country. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. It would be misguided, in our view, to break with the system that has worked so well for so long.
So what's his stance? If it were to pass, what would be the impact?
The digital marketplace of ideas that welcomes every blog and tweet is the same one that inspires the next generation of innovators to fuel our economies. And when businesses consider investing in a country with a poor record on internet freedom, and they know that their website could be shut down suddenly, their transactions monitored, their staffs harassed, they'll look for opportunities elsewhere.
So that's the end of the Joe Biden thing. So what do you guys think about Vice President coming out?
Is that CG, you said?
No, I'm saying that the video looks so good. Like they clearly did some color correction and stuff that just made it look like it was CG.
I got you.
I think that was from, is that like the conference that was in France a few months ago? Because they were looking at like a three strikes law or something like that.
The description on YouTube does not say.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's being cast as in the SOPA context, but I think it was at a European conference. Mm-hmm. You could see some banners in the background.
But I guess the point is that it applies, right?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. And I think this is an example of, you know, blindness to the golden rule of international relations, right? You know, if another country did the same thing, we'd be yelling at them. We're the U.S. We can do what we want,
of
right?
Of course we can. Why can't we? But the last article I had on there about SOPA was that fearing that this would pass, some guy made a Firefox add-on called DSOPA, which basically does HTTP DNS requests instead of port 53 DNS requests to offshore DNS servers to get you correct information whenever the U.S. starts sending you bad information.
So interesting.
But isn't the development of circumvention
probably
a violation of SOPA?
I'm sure it is.
I think that was one of the things they threw in there.
But if you did it before it's a law, can't the code be always...
It's not retroactive.
Yeah, if it's not retroactive.
But the use could be...
Well, they'd have to rewrite it to include use.
I have no idea, but it's out there.
Kept quiet.
So go get the plugin.
Yeah.
It's a link on Torrent Freak. So what do you guys think of SOPA in general? Any final thoughts?
It's bad. It's bad.
Yes, it is bad. So that is the end of our article section, I guess. Mm-hmm. And anything that we didn't talk about it. You know, it's been 2 months. Any cool things that have happened either you guys wanted to talk about?
I got my Galaxy Nexus.
Oh, the Galaxy Nexus.
Yeah, with ice cream sandwich.
I could go for an ice cream sandwich.
It's so delicious.
So how long have you had it?
About a week and change now.
I tried to convince Ryan to do an unboxing on the show.
I couldn't wait.
Yeah.
I couldn't wait.
A week was just too long. No. I thought you were going to get it today.
Yeah, no. Couldn't wait.
And then we could be like, Ryan is opening the box.
Yeah, I like it a lot. it the GPS on it soaks a good bit of battery. I think that's the case with most phones. So I have the GPS, like the hardware GPS part of it disabled, but and the battery life seems to be pretty acceptable.
What do you, how often do you recharge? How many days?
I still charge every night because I don't like being caught up somewhere without a charger.
I agree. If you were to let it go down to like the 10-20% mark,
it'd probably make it close to 2 days. Okay. But
that's what I'm at with my iPhone.
Obviously, it depends on use. And, you know, you can if the 4G seems to be really hogging the battery, you can always flip it back to 3G.
Yeah, so that kind of brings up the thing I wanted to mention for you guys. You know, since this is the last episode of 2010 or 2011, wow, 2010.
Yeah.
What were some cool things that, what were your likes and dislikes of this year? Obviously, your new phone is a like.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's kind of, I definitely like that.
Matt, any really cool things that came out this year that you were pumped about?
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and for me, it hasn't been a great year tech-wise.
I was thinking the same thing.
I didn't get a whole lot of new gear. I like Portal 2. Portal 2 was probably a highlight. I understand some new games have come out, like Skyrim and Arkham City, that look pretty good. I haven't played them yet, but I look forward to trying those. But, you know, we didn't get a whole lot of new toys. We've had, you know, bad news like the Carrier IQ and SOPA and, you know, all the hacking, Anonymous, all that stuff.
It's LulzSec,
a lot of depressing stuff.
We had Steve Jobs die.
Steve Jobs died, yeah. So I'm thinking not a great year. We had the flooding in Thailand now is wrecking the hard drive plants.
Yeah.
A 2 terabyte drive is up around $200 now. It was less than $100 a couple of months ago. The one interesting thing that could come from that is if we see SSDs take over in 2012. Maybe not take over, but get a bump in market share.
Yeah.
I like the new Ultrabooks that are coming out. Those machines are looking pretty good. So I think in 2012, we may be in the market for an Ultrabook for my wife.
So just for people who don't know, those are netbook style, but they're turnable monitors to be tablet or netbook?
No. These would be like the MacBook Air competitors running Windows.
Okay, so the ultra-thin, ultra-light.
14-inch ultra-thin, ultra-light machines, you know, typically like a Core i5 with an SSD, that no optical drive, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it was nice to see Intel get behind that push. I mean, most of the I think we had an article about that a while back. They invested something like $300 million, or yeah, it wasn't $300 billion. It was $300 million into the netbook market to get Dell and I don't know if Dell's in it, but you know, to get them to try it, because most of the PC manufacturers were unconvinced that they could compete in that segment, because they've been competing on price for the last 20 years,
right?
So,
yeah, Intel keeps rolling out nice product. The Sandy Bridge processors are nice. Sandy Bridge E. I think in 2012 we'll get Ivy Bridge, which is another shrink.
Yeah, and actually Apple has gone on record to say that a MacBook will be a MacBook Air. Like, start coming out next year, laptops will not be the way they are now. Their default laptop will be the Air style, which they are just going to call the MacBook.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, so I think that's the wave of the future.
The death of optical drives, I guess.
Yeah, seriously. I love my CD drive.
Yeah.
I don't want a machine without one.
Yeah, but the same technology is filtering into the, you know, say, regular, I want to say, 14-inch notebook class, where, yeah, they're not as thin as the Ultrabooks and the MacBook Air, but they're still getting a lot of the same gains in terms of shrinking down and getting lighter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you're looking forward to that in 2012. What about you, Ryan? Anything you really want to happen next year?
I tell you what, I'm really impressed with Ice Cream Sandwich so far, and I think that this next year is going to be a really big push for that version of the OS on, you know, a lot of Android devices. So I'm looking forward to seeing that deploy to a lot of tablets that have already been purchased. You know, like my Transformers was to get it, and I think the Galaxy Tab and what's the other big one? The Zoom, Motorola Zoom.
The Zoom.
So I think those are going to be big. I think that'll be big news for those, because like Honeycomb, and I just to sort of go back to 2011, I think Honeycomb was a big step up for for the Android OS in usability and smoothness and everything. And, you know, the tablets, they finally have a product in the tablet realm that I think it's close to competing. You know, it's definitely not as polished as the iPad.
Well, isn't ICS, Ice Cream Sandwich, now going to be their tablet OS now that they've kind of merged?
Yeah, it's both. That's the whole point. Yeah, it'll be both. They've merged the two forks, and or the fork, I guess it's sort of merged back together. Yeah. But I'm looking forward to that, you know, having this Ice Cream Sandwich like experience and seeing what it'll be like on a tablet, but also bringing along with it all the improvements, like the hardware acceleration and everything else that comes with it.
Yeah, so. I'm looking forward to, or maybe not looking forward to, 3D on television next year. And looking forward to the either glassesless or just a better non-headache-inducing 3D, since all TVs are pretty much having it now. But something that I didn't realize until I read it or heard about it, I forget where I heard about it recently, but the way they have to make 3D shows, that 3D shows that are made for 3D are a lot slower, less cuts, less fast cuts between scenes, more slow-moving action, because your eyes with the 3D need time to adjust so you don't get a headache. And somebody was bringing up that that's going to totally change everything, since everybody is pretty much going to make stuff for 3D now. The 3D is kind of, I guess, taking over.
It's going to affect the movie-making process.
It affects the movie-making process such that your normal 2D stuff will have the slowness, because there is also its 3D counterpart.
Right.
So,
yeah, I'm not sure if I like that.
Yeah, so that I'm looking at that as a problem next year.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the 3D stuff, so I hope it withers on the vine, I guess.
See, I saw How to Train Your Dragon in IMAX 3D. Freaking amazing. Like, I loved it. Seeing it in the theaters with non-battery headache-inducing glasses, like, it was just amazing. In my living room, not so sure. I don't want to wear glasses all the time. I'm still weary in the living room.
Yeah, I think the best critique of the 3D technology that out there with glasses, at least, is what Molly Wood said. She's like, I don't want to have to lay down on my side with a pair of 3D glasses, like, because a lot of people watch TV on a couch laying down, or reclined or whatever. Yeah. And I think wearing glasses, it can be a pain. That's like one of the my favorite things about having contacts is that I don't have to lay on them.
Yeah, I don't mind wearing my eyeglasses, my prescription eyeglasses, but putting another set of glasses in front of them is a huge pain in the butt.
Or having to go put contacts in and then a set of glasses, it's like, ah.
What if you get clip-on 3D?
That would be awesome.
then you're in, right?
Oh, yeah.
No sarcasm intended, huh?
No. I don't know. I'm prone to headaches and eye fatigue and all that stuff from the 3D stuff. I just have no interest in it.
Yeah, so I guess that was actually a worry of mine, not what I'm looking forward to.
You know, I worry about it affecting the movie-making process, but it might affect the movies I don't watch anyways. I'm not into the big action flicks anymore. I used to be, and I still occasionally will watch one. I watched A-Team today because it was, on TV, and I was like, hey, what the heck? But, you know, what I watch in movies, I prefer, I watch documentaries and I watch dramas and that sort of stuff. So I don't know.
More slow moving stuff anyways.
Yeah. It's not going to benefit from 3D. So I don't see a director using it. You know,
the History Channel is going to do World War II in color and 3D.
Oh yeah. Two things they didn't have.
Yeah. Or Wizard of Oz. Oh,
Wizard of Oz in 3D.
That'd be scary.
Oh, man.
You think kids are afraid of those flying monkeys now? You wait.
They already oversaturated the colors in the new release on Blu-ray. Yeah. I can't imagine what they're going to do if they make it 3D.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so I'm ending that section right now. So nothing else before we end it?
Nope.
So what's that, 2012? Good luck with all that?
Yeah, really. So some of us are looking for good things. Some of us are a little worried. So that is the end of this week's episode of the Slongcast. I don't even think I mentioned it was episode 44. Pretty sure I forgot that, but this was episode 44 for those of you who care.
Wow.
As usual, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. Ryan, where can people find you if they want to contact you?
You can find me at www.lancipedia.com or / Ryan Lancy on Twitter.
And Matt, what about you?
On Twitter, I'm Coneslayer, and my blog is ductwhiskey.com, Scotch Tape and Duct Whiskey, ductwhisky.com.
I always laugh whenever I go to your website because I think, oh, it can be taken two ways. That's why it's funny. So that is it. We will see you all in 2012.